battery in sequence, doubling the time the phone could operate, then opened up the menu. I spent a frustrating 20 minutes manipulating the software so that the camera would take a photo every 2 seconds. I taped the jury-rigged phone inside the Samsonite so that its camera lens was hard against the drilled-out lock, giving it a clear view of the room. Before I went out, I only had to turn the phone on, glue the fabric back, and return the suitcase to the top of the closet. I figured that the camera would be perfectly hidden, but the location had one other great advantage. People searching for something will look inside a box or suitcase, but hardly ever examine the object itself. I now had my own surveillance system, admittedly held together by wire and rope, but workable. I had to know for certain that the burglars had found what I was about to plant. Everything else depended on it. I took the freshly printed photo of Kumali's old home and added a computer disk which included a copy of her Bahrain driver's license, details of the scuba diving blog, and the précis of her college course in Istanbul. I put everything in a plastic file and placed it inside the in-room safe, a piece of crap with a battery-operated electronic keypad which any burglar worthy of the name would know how to power down, clear the code, and open. The photograph and documents were to convince Leila Kumali that Michael Spitz was hunting her. In addition, because they were genuine items, the so-called halo effect would wash over whatever else she found. I was counting on the scumboys also to steal my laptop. Inside, Kumali would find 2 emails, totally fake, which I had drafted on the flight across Jordan. I was checking them, inserting them in my inbox at the appropriate dates, when the hotel phone rang. A woman identified herself as being a secretary at the New York Homicide Bureau, but I figured it was bullshit. She was almost certainly one of Whisperer's back office staff.
The flight you are expecting is Turkish Airlines 349 from Rome, arriving at Milas International at 1528, she said.
I wasn't expecting any flight from Rome, but I guessed what had happened. Whisperer had figured a government jet would attract too many questions and had booked Bradley on a commercial flight. I glanced at my watch. I had 10 minutes if I was going to get to Milas in time. I finished checking the emails, but didn't delete any computer files. The material, which was genuinely confidential, was protected by unbreakable 128-bit encryption, and its presence would lend credibility to the subterfuge. The computer itself was password-protected, and there was some low-level code, but I was confident, as Whisperer had told me when he first gave it to me, that it could be busted quickly if somebody wanted to. I put the laptop in the safe alongside the other material, turned the Bulgarian phone on, re-glued the fabric, and went out the door fast. The bellhop, the young guy behind the reception desk, and the woman at the switchboard watched as I exited the elevator. I slid the room key along the desk and called to the phone operator, loud enough for them all to hear.
I'm going to the airport. Any calls, I'll be back at 5:30.
I knew that if Kumali was going to have my room turned over, the first thing she would do was try to discover my movements. Hopefully, I had just saved her and the scumboys some trouble. As I ran for my car, I figured that, by the time I returned, they would have entered the loading dock at the rear, gone up the service elevator, picked the lock on my door, and, to make it look like a plain vanilla hotel robbery, my room would be in chaos. I couldn't have been more wrong. Chapter 15. I got to the airport just in time. 2 minutes after I arrived, Bradley walked out of the customs zone. I guided him past the men with massive urns on their backs selling apple tea, endless crowds of hustlers and beggars, and an attractive Slavic couple who were almost certainly pickpockets, and out towards the parking lot. On the street, the wind was coming straight out of Asia, delivering a host of exotic scents, and loudspeakers were broadcasting in muezzin, telling Muslims that it was time for prayer. I saw Bradley looking at the chaotic traffic, the distant pine-clad hills, the minarets of a nearby mosque, and I knew it was setting him back on his heels. "We're close to the borders of Iraq and Syria," I said. "A bit different from Paris, huh?" He nodded. "People in my line of work get used to alien places," I continued. "But you never get used to the loneliness. It's good to see you."
"You too," he replied. "You gonna tell me why we're here?"
"No," I said, "but I'll tell you as much as necessary." We had arrived at the Fiat, and while I performed the usual deadly dance with the Turkish traffic, I asked Bradley to remove the batteries from both our cell phones. By the time I had explained why, we were on the freeway. We, that means the U.S. government, are hunting a man, I explained. We've been hunting him for weeks.
The guy everyone's talking about,
he asked.
The one with the nuclear trigger.
There is no guy with a nuclear trigger, I replied. That was a cover story. I saw the surprise on Bradley's face, and I knew what he was thinking. He had seen the president talking about it numerous times on TV. I didn't have time to explain the reason for that, and I kept going. A couple of days ago, we thought we had him nailed, but we were wrong. We don't have a name, a nationality, or his whereabouts. The only link we have is his sister.
Leila Kamali,
he said, his eyes flashing in a moment of realization. Yes. In the last 12 hours, she has been told that I am not here investigating a murder, that I am a CIA agent.
Are you?
No, I'm far beyond that. When we get to Bodrum, I believe we'll find she is organized to have my hotel room robbed. The thieves will have taken a number of items, including my laptop. It has several security features, but she will be able to access it without much trouble. Inside are two emails that she will find significant. The first will tell her that we intercepted coded phone calls between her and a man in the Hindu Kush.
The where?
Bradley asked. Afghanistan. She will read that we don't know the content of those calls, because they were in code, but given that she was born in Saudi Arabia, her father was publicly executed, and her phone friend has been involved in the abduction of three missing foreigners, we think that she is part of a terrorist undertaking.
Is she?
I don't believe so, but the document gives details of her impending rendition to Bright Light.
What's Bright Light?
She'll search the web and find a number of newspaper articles which claim that it's in Thailand, part of a system of CIA secret prisons.
Is it?
Yes.
What happens at Bright Light?
People are tortured.
Our country does that to women?
Our country does that to anybody. Ben had only been in country for 30 minutes, but already he was getting quite an education. I let him sit in somber silence for a moment as I overtook a convoy of Turkish military heading to the Syrian border. Kamali is the sole carer for a 6-year-old boy, I went on, once the tank transporters were vanishing in my rearview mirror. Obviously, the child can't be abandoned, so the document lays out the arrangements for his welfare. I pulled out my phone, replaced the battery, opened its file, and gave it to Ben. On the screen was one of the shots of the little guy I had taken in Kamali's kitchen.
He's Down syndrome,
said Bradley, looking up at me. Yes, I replied. The document says he will be picked up by our people and transported to an orphanage in Bulgaria, one of the poorest nations in Europe. Due to poverty and the fact that he is an alien, nothing will be done to cater for his special needs. Bradley didn't take his eyes off me. Sickened, I think. The purpose of the document is to panic her, I went on.
I think you just might succeed,
he replied.
Why?
We know she's able to contact our target. The problem has always been that, if we try to force her, she'll do it in a way that will warn him. He'll go to ground and we'll lose him completely. If, however, she thinks she's reading secret information and it panics her, she will contact the target voluntarily. No deliberate mistakes and no clever warnings. He's the only person who can help her, the only person who can tell her what is going on. And even if he wanted to ignore her, he can't. He's an Arab. He's her brother, and that makes him the head of the family. Bradley thought about it, then looked again at the photo he was still holding. The little guy was laughing. A child. Just a pawn in the great game.
You think this up all by yourself?
He asked. It wasn't admiration I heard in his voice. Pretty much, I said.
Is it always like this? Your work?
No, I replied, thinking about the two little girls in Moscow. Sometimes it's worse. Bradley took a breath.
Okay, so Kamali contacts her brother. What then?
She tells him about the second email. Chapter 16. I drifted over into the slow lane and scanned the traffic behind in the mirror. When I was satisfied that we hadn't picked up a tail, I walked Ben deeper into the shadow world. The second email claims to be from the deputy director of the CIA. It was dated 2 days ago, and it reports that we have had a breakthrough concerning the abduction of the three foreigners in the Hindu Kush.
But you haven't, have you?
Ben asked. No. The man and the events are a mystery. He's a lone wolf, an organization of one. There hasn't been any gossip and no chance of betrayal. We've been looking for a ghost. I swung down an off-ramp, heading for Bodrum. But we have glimpsed him, I continued. We know that he's been to Afghanistan twice. First, as a teenage Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, and then a few months back to abduct the three foreigners.
Why were those people taken?
I can't tell you that. Ben was offended, but I couldn't help it. There was no need for him to know, and that was the golden rule in the world he had entered. One aspect of the event, however, has been critical to our plan. Dave McKinley realized it. You can't abduct three people by yourself. Not in Afghanistan, not from different locations, not from fortified compounds. In that regard, our ghost must have had help. It has given us a way in. McKinley has done 2 tours in the GAN, and nobody in the Western world knows more about the country than him. He's certain it was old Muj comrades, probably one of the warlords who helped our man. Those ties run deep, and would explain why, despite 1,000 agents on the ground, we have heard nothing. The second email says that, in 2 days' time, one of those helpers, in return for a large cash reward and a new identity, will reveal the names of our ghost and all those who assisted him. We had reached the coast, and the setting sun was washing the azure sea with shades of pink. I doubted that Ben had seen anything as beautiful, but he barely registered it.
If that were true about the cash reward, what would happen to the men he betrays?
He asked. They would be interrogated, then handed over to the Afghan government.
And executed?
Yes. The email doesn't reveal the traitor's name, but it makes it clear that I know it.
So, if your target, if the ghost wants to save himself and his comrades, he has to find out from you the name of the turncoat and pass it on to the warlord fast.
That's right, I replied. Our target has to come to the waterhole. He has to come to Bodrum and get me to talk. And he'll have less than a day to do it.
Then you grab him.
No. Bradley reacted.
No? What do you mean no? I thought—
Grabbing him won't help. The man has information we need. Let's say he has sent a package to America, or is about to, and we have no chance of finding it. We have to get him to tell us the shipping details.
Torture him.
No, same problem as with his sister. By the time we discover he has sold us a raft of crap, it's too late. The package has already arrived. No, he has to tell us voluntarily. Bradley laughed.
How are you going to get him to do that?
I'm not, I replied. You are. Chapter 17.
No!
Ben was shouting, staring at me. I had never seen him so angry. I had just explained how we were going to force the Saracen to reveal the so-called delivery arrangements, and now that I had finished, he wasn't bothering to hide his disgust at even being in the same car as the idea.
I won't do it. Nobody fucking would. What sort of person, what sort of mind, thinks up something like that?
Then give me a better idea, I replied, trying to keep it calm. I don't like it any more than you do.
Oh, yeah? You're forgetting you chose this life.
I didn't. If you recall, I was trying to leave it. This life chose me. I was pissed off. The last thing I needed was a lesson in morality. I hit the brake and swung into the parking lot of the cafe with the panoramic view of Bodrum and the sea.
I'm not interested in a fucking view,
Bradley said. I pulled in so that you could have some privacy.
Privacy for what?
To talk to Marcy. Again, I stopped far away from the crowd on the terrace. I started to get out of the car so that he could be alone.
What am I speaking to Marcy for?
He demanded. You told me once her parents had a beach house, in North Carolina or somewhere.
What's a beach house got to do with it?
Have they got one or not? I insisted.
On the Outer Banks. Why?
Tell her to drive there, now, tonight.
Here's an idea. She might want to know the reason.
I ignored it. Tell her to pick up as much food and bottled water as she can. Staples, rice, flour, gas bottles. She's got to remember gas bottles, as many as she can find. He stared, the anger gone.
You're scaring me, Scott.
Brody. The name is Brody.
Sorry.
Don't be scared. You're safe up where you are, on the moral high ground. Can she shoot?
Sure. I taught her.
Get long arms, rifles, shotguns. I'll tell you the best make and model numbers in a minute. Once she's set up in the house, I can walk her through how to convert them to full automatic. She'll need ammunition, lots of ammunition. Bradley tried to interrupt. Shut up. Anybody approaches the house, at 200 yards, she tells them to back off. They keep coming, and she shoots to kill. No warning shots. 200 yards is important. At that distance, there's no chance of her inhaling aerosol particles and becoming infected. I saw the fear spark in his eyes.
Infected with what?
A virus, highly contagious and resistant to any known vaccine. This version is being called evasive hemorrhagic, and it is believed to have a 100% kill rate. That is what is being sent into the homeland. Smallpox. Ben Bradley, a homicide cop from Manhattan, a hero of 9/11, someone taking only the second overseas trip of his life, an outsider drafted into the secret world less than 12 hours before, a guy sitting on an isolated lookout high above the Turkish coast, the bravest man I have ever met, was now the 11th person to know. Chapter 18. We wound our way down into Bodrum in silence. Ben never called Marcy. Faced with a choice between two evils, and unable to come up with an alternative to my plan for finding out the truth from the Saracen, he chose the lesser of them.
Take me through the arrangements again,
he had said, once he had overcome his shock and fear on hearing about the unfolding catastrophe. When I had finished explaining the plan again and answered a host of questions, even down to the length of rope and how tight to make the noose, I put the car into gear, swept past the terrace, and hit the road. I concentrated on the driving, slowing only when we hit Bodrum and started to weave through the back streets. Once I got close to the house I was looking for, I pulled to the curb and parked a good 50 yards away. I pointed it out to Ben, made him name 10 significant features, and then repeat them. It was a standard way of imprinting a memory, and most studies showed that, even under extreme stress, a subject would remember 6 of them. Satisfied that, even in the pounding whirl of a live mission, Bradley would find the correct house, I pulled out and drove to the hotel. While Ben went to the reception desk, I headed for my room, anxious to see how much damage Kamali's scumboys had done. As I stepped into the elevator, I saw the manager smile and take Ben's passport.
Ah, Mr. Benjamin Michael Bradley, he said. I will need of the credit cards 3 from you to put me on the side of the safe.
Say again, said Ben.
Chapter 19. There was nothing. I was standing just inside my hotel room, and not a thing had been touched. I closed the door behind me and moved to the closet, keyed in the code to the safe and opened it. The laptop and the plastic file were exactly where I had left them. I swept my eyes around the room. Where the hell had I gone wrong? How had Kamali seen through it? Had the Turkish MIT guy tipped her off, either deliberately or inadvertently? I didn't think so. He had far too much at risk to blow it for one phone call to a lowly cop. So why hadn't she taken the bait? With my mind jumping from theory to theory, I walked around the room. I passed the unmade bed. I had put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door when I left so that the scumboys wouldn't be disturbed, and stepped into the bathroom. Everything was how I had left it. Unthinking, I bent to pick up a towel I had left on a stool, and saw that the tube of toothpaste was sitting on the shelf where I'd put it. Ever since I was a kid, I'd had a strange habit, though. I had always laid my toothbrush along the top of the tube. Now, it was sitting next to it. Somebody had moved them to open the bathroom cabinet. I wheeled around, entered the bedroom, and hauled the suitcase off the top of the closet. I was relieved to see that, even if an intruder had looked inside, they hadn't found the Bulgarian phone. It was still hidden inside the lining. I pulled it free of its tape, clicked on an icon, and opened the photos, which had been taken at 2-second intervals. I quickly saw that the scum boys had come all right. They were just way better than I had anticipated. The time code showed that two men had entered my room 32 minutes after I had departed. One photo showed them face-on in perfect focus. A pair of hard-eyed hipsters in their early 30s, wearing expensive leather jackets and carrying backpacks. Their quick, efficient movements and the minimum of conversation told me that they were professionals. I had turned the phone's microphone on, and that gave me a barely audible recording of their muffled voices. While I couldn't understand what they were saying, I recognized the language. They were Albanians. In retrospect, that should have set alarm bells ringing. Their nationality also explained the ease with which they had entered the room. Standing in the background of one frame, I saw the bellhop, their countrymen and fellow sleaze, being handed a wad of cash. I figured that, after they paid him, he returned to slouching in an alcove in the foyer, acting as their lookout in case I returned early. There were thousands of photos. Thank God the two batteries had held out, but by flicking through them and knowing exactly how professionals worked, I managed to build a picture of exactly what they had done. The photo showed the leader, the one giving the orders, shrugging off his leather jacket and getting down to work. Underneath, he was wearing a skin-tight black t-shirt. Chosen, I was sure, because it accentuated how ripped he was. A lot of steroids, I thought. He pulled a digital camera out of one of the backpacks, and before they searched the clutter on the small desk, he photographed it so that they could replace everything in exactly the same position. I figured they followed the same procedure as they worked fast through everything else. No wonder, apart from the slightly misplaced toothbrush, I hadn't thought anyone had been inside. They turned their attention to the safe, and though the photos weren't very clear, I could tell it offered no resistance. Muscle Man would have turned its cheap circular keypad counterclockwise and popped it out, revealing the power supply and circuitry. That allowed him to remove the batteries, clearing the code, and plug in his own keypad. A bracket of 10 photos showed that he had the door open in under 20 seconds. They took out the plastic folder and photographed the shot of Kamali's childhood home before Muscle Man produced his own laptop, slipped the disk into it, and copied its contents. As soon as it was finished, they turned their attention to my computer. I didn't need to wade through all the surveillance photos to know what they did. They used a tiny screwdriver to remove my hard drive and then inserted it into their own computer, bypassing most of my laptop's security features. With the help of code-generating software, they would have broken through the remainder of the defenses and been able to access all my documents and emails within minutes. From there, it was a simple matter to copy everything onto USB portable drives, return my hard drive to the laptop, and put everything back in the safe. I flew through the rest of the covert photos and saw that the men had searched the other parts of the room, entered the bathroom, and were out of the door, carrying everything they needed, 26 minutes after they had arrived. I sat on the bed and looked at a photo of them leaving. My hand was trembling with relief. It had been successful. The first stage was over. Kamali had believed the phone call from our man at MIT and acted exactly as we had hoped. There was no doubt that she would be able to read the stolen data, and that meant the next steps were now entirely in her hands. Would she believe what she saw in the emails? In my fatigue and anxiety, had I made some small but fatal error? Would she be sufficiently panicked, terrified of bright light for herself and a Bulgarian orphanage for the child, to code up a message and contact her brother? Perhaps if I hadn't been so preoccupied with those questions, I would have paid more attention to the photo I was holding. I knew that there were 7 major drug cartels operating in the area, and that one of them, run by a lavender farmer out of Thessaloniki in Greece, had a heartfelt interest in the activities of American intelligence agents. Had I been more attentive, I would have thought about who was the most likely person Kamali would find to do her dirty work, or maybe even recognize something about one of the men whose image I had captured. But I didn't, and there was a knock on the door. I looked through the peephole and saw it was Bradley.
Did the burglars come?
He asked. Yeah, I replied. He slumped down in a chair.
What about that manager, huh?
The professor? What about him? He turned and looked.
The professor? Professor of what?
English, I said. Bradley almost smiled, much to my relief. It meant he was overcoming the disgust he had felt at the role he had been given. In the event that everything went ahead, I needed him calm and totally committed. My life would depend on it. Chapter 20.
What happens now?
Bradley asked. He had left my room, returned to his own, unpacked and showered. Looking less haggard and seemingly more relaxed, he was sitting with me in the hotel's dining area. It was 9 p.m. and we were picking at plates of mezze, neither of us with much appetite, the anxiety bearing down. We were alone. The season was dying fast, and the hotel's few other guests had already headed out to beachside bars and restaurants. The next step is that Kumali reads the fake emails. Then we hope she contacts her brother, I replied.
How will we know if she does?
Echelon, I said.
What's Echelon?
Something that doesn't exist. But, if it did, it would be listening to cell phones, fixed lines, emails, every communication in this part of Turkey. In particular, it would be monitoring one phone box 4 miles from here.
And if Kumali does contact him, when do you think she'll do it?
The same question had been occupying my thoughts. She should have received the stolen information by now, I replied. The way the Albanians took it means she won't have to spend time trying to unlock it. The passwords are already broken. Assuming she believes everything she reads, it'll scare her badly. She'll keep rereading it, trying to find other stuff on the hard drive, wasting time. Finally, the worst of the shock, maybe even a bout of nausea, will have passed. She'll sit at her computer in her old fisherman's house and post a message on an internet forum or dating site. Almost immediately, the Saracen will receive a text message from the same site saying that someone who shares his interests has just posted an entry. He'll know what it means. He has to contact her urgently, probably at some prearranged time. Meanwhile, Kumali has to record grabs from English-language news programs and code up a message. The anxiety will slow her down, and then she's got to drive to the phone box and wait for him to call. I figure, by the time she's done everything, Echelon will hear something by no later than midnight. That's our drop-dead time. If it doesn't, I guess she will have seen through it, and we're finished.
And say Echelon does hear. McKinley will call you and tell you that the man is probably on his way?
Asked Bradley. Yeah, McKinley's message will be short. He'll just say something like, "Buddy, you're live."
Midnight,
Ben said quietly, and looked at a clock above the fireplace.
3 hours to go.
He almost laughed.
It's gonna be a long night.
Yeah, I replied coolly. Over the years, I'd had a lot of long nights, and I had learned something about patience. Two choices. You want to play cards, or hear a story?
I don't know,
he responded.
Is it a good story?
Judge for yourself, I said. It's about a woman called Ingrid Cole. Chapter 21. Not all death warrants are signed by judges or governors, I explained. This one was a prenup agreement. Ben and I had moved from the dining room into the lounge, a cozy place with an open fire, a lazy cat, and a good view across the lobby to the front door, just in case Kumali or the Albanians had a different plan and came calling. The man and woman in question had known each other for 6 weeks when they decided to marry, I continued. Her name was Cameron, his was Dodge, and there was $1.2 billion at stake.
No wonder there was a prenup,
Ben said, lifting a beer. If ever there was a night for a drink, I thought, this was the one, but I managed to push the idea aside. Cameron had been working as a glorified sales assistant, so she didn't have much bargaining power, or access to good advice. Needless to say, it was a tough agreement. If she divorced Dodge, especially in the first 5 years, she got next to nothing. On the other hand, as a widow, she got everything. So, if she fell out of love...
And wanted real money,
Ben added. Dodge hadn't signed a prenup.
He'd signed a death warrant,
the homicide detective said, raising his eyebrows, impressed. A couple of months later, Cameron decided she didn't want to be with Dodge anymore, I said.
Another party involved?
There usually is. In this case, it was a woman.
Wow. This is the gift that keeps on giving,
Ben said. Now, you have to understand, there are a few things I don't know. I've had to guess at them, make some assumptions, rely on experience, but I know I'm right. He nodded.
Sure. You're the one investigator I wouldn't argue with.
My intuition is that the two women had grown up together. I think they were lovers before Dodge entered the frame, I went on. Anyway, let's call Cameron's friend Marilyn. I don't know her real name. I stole a glance at my watch. Only 20 minutes gone. I didn't know it, but apparently time passed slowly when you were waiting for the end of the world. They had left Turkey Scratch, or wherever they grew up, and moved to Manhattan, full of dreams, I suppose. Cameron got a job at Prada, and Marilyn wanted to be an actress. In other words, she took a job in an office.
Then Cameron met the billionaire,
said Ben. Yeah, it was a whirlwind, but Cameron must have known it was her one chance at a fortune. Lightning never strikes twice. Maybe she sat down and discussed it with Marilyn. Perhaps it was all very civilized, but in my experience, life's a lot messier than that. My guess is she dumped her lifelong friend. Whatever happened, she married him. One thing I'm certain of, Dodge never met Marilyn or even saw her. That was important for what happened later.
Okay,
Ben said.
So, Dodge and Cameron get married, but it doesn't work out.
It didn't take long. Even though I believe that Marilyn felt betrayed, Cameron reestablished contact. She wanted to be rid of Dodge, but she had a problem.
The prenup.
Right. But the women saw a way round it. They could have each other and the money. Kill him.
That was their plan?
Ben asked. They didn't know. Then one morning, a group of terrorists helped them out. 9/11. The office where Marilyn worked was located in one of the towers, but she was running late. She saw the planes hit and realized that, as far as the world was aware, she was dead. For a would-be murderer, there was no better alibi. I looked up and saw three fellow guests come through the front door and head for the elevator. As usual, the tradecraft was running in the back of my mind, and I knew that all the residents were now in for the night. In the next 10 minutes, the young duty manager would lock the front door, check that the loading bay and service elevator were secure, and dim the house lights. I looked at a clock on the mantel. Its hands were barely moving. Where was Kamali? Where in hell was Echelon?
But Marilyn had to stay dead,
said Ben, dragging me back to New York in 9/11. That's right. So she walked through the smoke and body parts and found the perfect place to live off the grid. The East Side Inn. She was an actress, and she used her craft to make sure nobody could recognize or describe her. Every day she played a different role. Ben nodded.
Yeah, I never did get a photo fit. She must have started planning right away. That took her to the New York Library and your book.
Right. An appendix at the back deals with the clear-up rate of homicides in different countries. A few minutes reading would have told her that there were a lot better places to kill someone than America. Turkey was perfect. There was little use of forensics, and investigators were overworked. Cameron would have had no trouble convincing Dodge to cruise the Aegean, but that created a big problem for Marilyn.
Dead people can't get passports,
Bradley said. I nodded. The lights throughout the hotel started to dim. The cat stretched. Bradley and I looked at the clock on the mantel. 125 minutes to go. I took a break, walked over and poured myself a coffee. My hands were shaking. Chapter 22. They were watching the clock in Washington, too. It was mid-afternoon on the East Coast, and Whisperer had made his own estimate of when Echelon would hear a coded message from Kamali. It was even earlier than mine. If it was going to happen, he calculated, it would be no later than 11 p.m., Bodrum time. He was either more of a pessimist or a realist than me. When there were 60 minutes left by his count, he closed the door of his office, stopped all phone calls, and gave strict orders that he wasn't to be disturbed. If the president needed him, there was a direct, secure line on his desk, and in the event of good news, the NSA would flash the details to him on a dedicated internet channel. In his heart, he didn't think it was likely. Experience had taught him that wishing didn't count for anything, and he had seen too much madness, too much fanaticism to expect any terrorist plan ever to end well. On his first tour in Afghanistan, as a young analyst, he had been seriously wounded by a pregnant woman wearing a bomb belt, and, as station chief years later, he had seen kids clutching grenades run towards GIs while asking for candy. No, he was certain. Very soon the president would order the closing of the borders. The panic would start. The queues for vaccine would stretch for miles. Troops would be in the streets, and the terrible search for suicide infectees would start. As soon as the president had finished addressing the nation, Whisperer would hand him the document, which he was now starting to write. It was his resignation. He wrote with his usual brutal honesty, but with a sadness that weighed so heavily he thought it might crush him. A sadness for his country, for the citizens he had failed, for his kids who he barely knew, for a career that had started 30 years ago with such huge promise and was now ending in historic failure. The clock on his desk ran down. The internet channel was open, his screen alight, until it hit nothing. Time was up. There was no word from Echelon, and, for once in his life, it brought him only misery to be proven right. He opened his drawer and had the cuff around his arm to check his blood pressure when the secure phone flashed its bubble light. He picked it up.
"Nothing?"
asked the president, not even trying to mask his anxiety.
"No," replied Whisper. "Kamali obviously didn't swallow it. Some small but critical mistake, I guess. Pilgrim calculates the drop-dead time differently. He says another 57 minutes, but it won't change anything. What do you want to do? Go to the people now?"
There was silence for a long moment as Grosvenor tried to bring order to his tumultuous thoughts.
"No,"
he said finally.
"I gave him 36 hours. We play it out. He deserves that."
Grosvenor hung up, devastated for the nation and its people, aware that the public and history would be merciless in their judgment. An hour earlier, like Whisper, he had also cleared his agenda and stopped his calls, so he now sat alone in the afternoon's swelling silence. He leaned his head into his hands and wished that Anne was still alive. He wished that they had had children. He wished that there was a family in whose arms he could find comfort and meaning. But there was nothing. Just a gale of fear blowing down the lonely corridors of his mind. Chapter 23. Bradley and I were in a different corridor. We were heading through the gloomy silence of the hotel towards my room. With less than 30 minutes left before the deadline, I had wanted to walk off some of the crushing anxiety, and I had suggested to Bradley that I give him the Turkish police files concerning Dodge's death. Knowing that they would be crucial to a future prosecution, he agreed, and we said goodnight to the lazy cat and headed across the deserted foyer. We were about to step into the elevator when I stopped. I had a strong sense we were being watched. There was nobody around, not even the duty manager, but there was a CCTV camera mounted on a wall, trained on the reception desk in its safe, and I wondered who might be in some office nearby observing us. Quietly, I told Ben to take the elevator while I used the stairs. A group of assailants, Albanians for instance, would find it very difficult to deal with a target which suddenly split apart. The cop looked a question at me. "I need the exercise," I said. He knew I was bullshitting, and I jagged left as he stepped into the elevator car. I took the stairs two at a time and met him without incident just as the steel doors opened. He stared at me and raised his eyebrows. I had the Beretta 9mm out and cocked.
"Hand weight?"
he asked, deadpan. I lowered it, and together we headed towards my room. I still had the feeling we were being observed, but the corridor wasn't equipped with cameras, and though I turned fast and looked behind us into the gloom. I saw nothing. I unlocked the door, and a thought occurred to me. The bellhop could still be in the building, ordered by whoever had recruited him to keep an eye on me. I closed the door behind us, bolted it, and put the pistol on the coffee table, within easy reach.
"We were in Manhattan,"
Bradley reminded me.
"Cameron and Marilyn had decided to kill Dodge in Turkey, but there was a problem."
"Yeah, Marilyn needed a passport," I said. "So they started searching. They were looking for a woman in her 20s, a loner, new in town maybe, definitely somebody who wouldn't be missed."
"Did they find her?"
"Sure."
"Where?"
"A gay bar, Craigslist, Washington Square on a Sunday afternoon, I don't know, it doesn't matter. But Marilyn took her out on a date. Later in the evening, she invited her back to the East Side Inn with the promise of drugs and sex. Instead, she killed her." We looked at one another. "She killed her for her identity, Ben," I said. Bradley said nothing, thinking about it, like any good cop trying to work out how to blow holes in it. "You recall a woman at your seminar?" I continued. "Turquoise shirt, very intelligent, sitting at the front?"
"Sure. I don't think she was intelligent, though. You told her women found you sexually attractive, and she agreed."
I laughed. "She said that the murder might have had something to do with identity theft, but I wasn't concentrating. Remember those guys arrived and sat at the back? I should have listened, though. She got it right."
"And you say the name of the dead woman was Ingrid Cole?"
Bradley said.
"That was the woman we found in the acid."
"Yes," I replied. "Marilyn was dead. She had no identity, so she had to destroy Ingrid's face, her fingerprints, and pull her teeth. She couldn't allow the body to be identified. She was going to steal her name and become her. Once the real Ingrid was dead, she had her wallet, her handbag, and apartment keys. She cleaned out room 89, sprayed it with industrial antiseptic, took one final pass, burned anything else she found, and headed out."
"You think she moved into Ingrid's apartment?"
"I don't know. She chose a loner, so it was possible. Whatever happened, Marilyn would have immediately gone through Ingrid's possessions. In a few hours, she would have had a social security number and everything else she needed to get a birth certificate."
"And with a birth certificate, you can get a passport,"
Bradley said. "That's right," I replied, and started to assemble the files relating to Dodge's murder. I glanced at the digital clock on the nightstand. 15 minutes to go, and tried not to think of failure. There was still time. Just one phone call and a short message was all we needed.
"So, she's now Ingrid Cole and has a legitimate passport with her own picture in it to prove it,"
Bradley said. "She flew to Europe," I explained, "established a history as a young backpacker, and arrived in Turkey 4 months ahead of Cameron and Dodge."
"What was the plan? How were she and Cameron going to kill him?"
"I'm not sure they knew. I think they were going to figure it out here. An accidental fall off the back of the boat one night, a hot shot of bad drugs, wait till he was loaded and drown him in the bath. But Ingrid got lucky. She met a hustler who used the name Gianfranco, a guy who knew more about the house where Dodge was staying than anyone. I think he had a scam going on. If there was nobody in residence, he'd take young women through a secret tunnel and have sex with them in the locked mansion."
"A secret way into the house?"
Ben said.
"That must have been all Ingrid needed."
"Yeah," I replied, handing him the stack of files. 10 minutes left. Dodge and Cameron sailed into Bodrum on their boat and met Ingrid around the clubs. Just casual, nothing special. Dodge had never seen Cameron's lover, so he had no reason to suspect Ingrid was anything more than she appeared. The two women waited till they knew he was alone on the estate, the night of a big fireworks display, and Ingrid made her way into the boathouse and along the tunnel. Dodge was in the library on a massive drug binge when a woman he had met burst into the room. Of course, he assumed she had been let in by security. My theory is that, seemingly out of breath, she told him that a helicopter with Cameron on board had just gone down in the bay.
"Shit,"
said Ben, shocked at the ruthless ingenuity of it. "Naturally, Dodge believed her," I said, not that he was in much of a state for rational thought. He was completely loaded, full of self-loathing and disgust, too.
How do you know?
He had a series of cuts on the palms of his hands. The cops thought it was because he'd grabbed a bush on the cliff as he fell, but the wounds were too regular for that. He had been doing it to himself in the library. It's not uncommon among drug abusers. It was self-harming. Ben was silent.
Poor guy,
he said finally.
All the money in the world, and he's alone, sitting with a knife.
His voice was swallowed by the sadness of it. He grabbed a pair of binoculars and Ingrid led him down the lawn, I said. Desperate to see what had happened to Cameron, he stood on a railing. Ingrid probably offered to hold his waist. Everything turned out perfectly. Ingrid gave him a tiny push. He was flying through the air, and $1 billion was knocking on their door. I shrugged. That was it. Finished. Ben looked at me.
Ever seen one as good as this?
He asked.
Even if the Turkish cops thought it was murder, there was nothing to connect Ingrid to Cameron.
Nothing at all, I replied. How could she even be a suspect? There was no past relationship, no present involvement, no motive. Ben just shook his head.
Brilliant.
Sure was, I said. Both the murders. This one and the one in Manhattan. Ben had found a file he was interested in and opened it up. It showed the passport photo of Ingrid, and he stared at her beautiful face.
If you're right about the rejection, I guess Ingrid must have really loved Cameron. To have been thrown aside in favor of some guy, to take her back and then to kill for her. Not once, but as you say, twice.
I had never thought about it like that. Yeah, I guess that's true, I said. A strange sort of love, though. Of course, I should have remembered what Ingrid had said when I interviewed her, about not understanding the half of it. It was arrogance on my part, I suppose. I was so certain that I had unraveled the whole crime. Bradley was too.
How unlucky were they? He said. They had committed what was near enough to the perfect murders, and they would have got away with it too, except the highest level of the United States intelligence community and one of its investigators became focused on this town.
Bad luck for them, maybe. Not for us, I said. Without Ingrid and Cameron, I wouldn't have had the perfect cover. We would never have got as close as we have. God help them, but they were an important part of what could have been a great victory.
It's over?
He asked in surprise, looking at the clock. 4 minutes to go.
You don't think he's going to call?
I shook my head. I didn't tell you, but McKinley had his own estimate of when we could expect to hear. I was the outrider. He was an hour earlier.
What happens now?
He asked quietly. Get on the phone, I said. Book the first plane home. If you leave at dawn, you can probably get back before they close the airports. Then do what I suggested. Take Marcy and head straight for the beach house. Together, you'll have a chance.
Better with three, he replied. Come with us.
I smiled but shook my head. No, I'll go to Paris.
Paris?
He said, shocked.
Cities are going to be the worst places.
Yeah, but I was happy there. I had a lot of dreams. If it gets really bad, I'd like to be close to that. He looked at me for a long moment. Sad, I think, but it was hard to tell. Then he started to ask me how long it would take for the virus to burn out, I held my hand up, signaling him to be quiet. I thought I had heard something outside in the hall. We both stood frozen, listening. Then we heard it together. Footsteps. I grabbed the Beretta off the nightstand and glided silently to the peephole. Ben drew his pistol and trained it on the point where the door would open. I looked through the spy hole and saw the shadow of a man on the wall. He was coming closer. Chapter 24. The man stepped into view. It was the bellhop. Unaware he was being watched, he pushed an envelope under the door. I waited until he had left before I put the pistol down and picked it up. Watched by Ben, heart racing, my thoughts veering between hope and ruthless restraint, I opened the flap and pulled out a single sheet of paper. I read it, felt the wall of anxiety collapse, and shook my head in wonder.
"What is it?"
said Ben. "I'm a fool," I replied. There was never going to be any message that Echelon could hear. Kamali didn't need to go to the phone box. The man is already here.
"In Bodrum? How do you know?"
I indicated the letter. "She wants to pick me up at 11 in the morning. She's invited me to go on a picnic with her supposed son."
"No, you're wrong,"
Ben responded.
"What can happen if the boy's there?"
I laughed. "He won't be," I said. "She'll make an excuse. Why else would she suddenly invite me to a picnic? She can't stand me. No, her brother's here, Ben. Tomorrow, I'm going to meet him." Bradley's doubts died under the weight of my certainty, and I saw the look on his face. I could tell he was dreading the role he would now have to play. To be honest, I wasn't looking forward to mine either. I unbolted the door for him. "Call Whisperer fast. Just tell him, buddy, we're live." Chapter 25. I had come to Turkey as a pathfinder and ended up as a lure. Consequently, I'd made no effort to put my affairs in order before I left, and now I found I had to do it fast. As soon as Bradley had left to call Whisperer, I sat down at the small desk, pulled out a piece of paper, and, late as it was, started to write my will. In normal circumstances, with just a government pension, the annuity from Grace, and a small collection of paintings, I wouldn't have bothered. But things had become more complicated. When Ben and Marcy had blown my cover and forced me to leave Paris, one of the few things I had thrown into my bag were the two letters from the New York lawyer about the deaths of both Bill and Grace. The elderly lawyer's name was Finbar Hanrahan, the son of penniless Irish immigrants, a man of such integrity that he threatened single-handedly to give lawyers a good name. He had been Bill's lawyer since before he had married Grace, and I had met him many times over the years. With the two letters in hand and back in New York, I had made an appointment to see him. So it was, late one afternoon, that he rose from behind the desk in his spectacular office and greeted me warmly. He led me to a sofa in the corner from which there was a view all the way up Central Park, and introduced me to the other two men in attendance, one of whom I recognized as a former Secretary of Commerce. Finbar said that they were lawyers, but neither of them was associated with his firm.
"They have read certain documents, and I have asked them to be here as impartial observers. Their job is to ensure that everything I do is by the book and cannot be misconstrued or questioned later. I want to be scrupulous about this."
It seemed strange, but I let it ride. I figured Finbar knew what he was doing. "You said in your letter there was a small matter of Bill's estate that had to be finalized," I said. "Is that what we're dealing with?"
"Yes," he said, "but there's an important issue we have to resolve first."
He looked at the two wise men, and they nodded. "Let's do it," they seemed to be saying.
"You may not know this," Finbar said, "but Bill cared about you very much. More than that, he believed that in some way you were special. He thought you were destined to do something very important."
I grinned. "Yeah, one of Grace's friends told me that. Obviously, he'd become unhinged." Finbar smiled.
"Not unhinged, no, although he did become increasingly concerned about you, especially after you left Harvard and went to live in Europe. Frankly, he didn't believe you were involved in the art business at all."
The news didn't surprise me. Bill had been not only intelligent, but also highly intuitive. I didn't reply. I just looked at the elderly lawyer, poker-faced.
"Bill had no idea how you earned money," he continued, "and was worried that you had become involved in a business that was either illegal or, at least, immoral."
He waited for a reply, but I nodded and made no comment.
"He said that on several occasions when he tried to talk to you about it, you were not what he called forthcoming."
Again, I just nodded.
So this is my question, Scott. What exactly do you do?
Nothing right now, I replied. I'm back in New York to see if I can find something that might grab my interest. I didn't think it was a good idea to tell him I was looking for cover, running from my past.
Yes, but before that...
I worked for the government, I said, after a pause.
Well, it seems like half the country does that, although I use the term work loosely.
He had a pretty wry sense of humor, old Finbar.
What exactly did you do for the government?
I'm sorry, I said. I have been told not to talk about it. I saw the two wise men exchange a glance. They obviously didn't believe it.
Told by whom?
Finbar said, ignoring them. I felt sorry for him. It was clear he really wanted it to work out. By executive order, I replied quietly. The former Secretary of Commerce raised his eyes. It was getting too much for him.
You worked in Europe, but the White House won't allow you to discuss it. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Secretary.
There's got to be somebody, a superior or someone, we can talk to about it, even in general terms, Finbar said.
I don't think that's possible, I replied. I've probably gone too far already. And anyway, the division, which had never officially existed, had already been buried. Finbar sighed.
Bill was very clear, Scott. We can't go forward unless I'm satisfied about your integrity and honesty. You'll have to help us.
I can't. I've given my word not to speak about any of it. I signed undertakings. I think they were surprised at the harshness and finality of my tone.
Then I'm afraid...
Sadly, the lawyer looked at the other two men for confirmation, and they nodded.
I'm afraid we have to terminate this meeting.
I stood up, and the others did the same. I was disappointed that I would never know what Bill had intended, but I didn't know what else to do. The former Secretary of Commerce was putting out his hand in farewell when a thought occurred to me. I have a letter of commendation which might help. It concerns an event I was involved in some years ago.
An event? What sort of event? A charity run or something?
The former secretary asked. Not exactly, I replied. Some parts of the letter would have to be blacked out, but I think you could see it.
Who's it from?
Finbar asked eagerly. From the president. It's handwritten on White House stationery. The three men didn't say anything. Finbar looked as if he'd have to bend down and pick his jaw up off the floor. The former secretary was the first to recover, still skeptical.
Which president?
He asked. Your old boss, I said coldly. I didn't like the guy much. Anyway, call him, I continued. I'm sure you have a number. Ask him for permission to read the letter. Tell him it concerns a young man and a terrible event in Red Square. I'm sure he'll remember. The former secretary had no response, and Finbar filled the silence.
We should stop here, he said. I think we've stumbled into an area concerning national security.
You sure have, I replied. Finbar looked at the other two lawyers, addressing the former secretary.
Jim, if you wouldn't mind, could you make that phone call later, just as a formality?
He nodded.
In the meantime, we're in agreement, then,
Finbar continued.
We're satisfied. We can move forward.
The two men nodded, but I could tell from the way the former secretary was looking at me that he had been in the cabinet meeting when the death of the Rider of the Blue had been discussed. He had probably never thought he would come face to face with the man who killed him. Chapter 26 Finbar took a file out of a wall safe. The other two lawyers shrugged off their jackets, and from our eyrie, I looked out at rain squalls sweeping down the park towards us, still with no idea what was going on.
As you know, when Bill died, his very substantial wealth was held in a series of trusts, which then passed in their entirety to Grace,
Finbar explained, opening the file.
There was, however, one small but special part of his life that was quarantined in a separate corporate structure. What it contained had been built up over years, and quite honestly, Grace had never shown any interest in it. Before he died, Bill made arrangements with my